Blog Talk Radio.
This is BC Radio Live with Eric, Lisa, and Philip, live online at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio. Aloha! Tonight on BC Radio Live, we plan to talk to Randy Illig about his book, Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play, Transforming the Buyer-Seller Relationship. We also hope to speak with Jeff Colvin, author of Talent is Overrated, What Really Separates World-Class Performers from Everybody Else. Today is Wednesday, the 14th day of 2009, and this is BC Radio Live. The chat room is now open at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio, and the live video feed is now running. I am Philip Wynn, button pusher for BC Radio Live and chief geek at BC Magazine, and I am joined tonight by BC Magazine's executive editor, Lisa McKay. Hello, Lisa.
Greetings, Philip.
Great to have you on the show. And we're also joined by BC Magazine's founder and publisher, Eric Olson. Good evening, Eric.
Hello, Philip and Lisa. How are you? We're in a severe deep freeze here, although not the kind of numbers I'm hearing. The upper Midwest, we're not below zero, but we're in the teens, and it's chilly.
We're headed there tomorrow.
That's right. We usually get it first, and then it often ends up with you there in Connecticut.
Yeah, we're getting snow. Yep.
I love it when I'm able to report 80-degree temperatures while you guys are freezing, but unfortunately it's been pretty chilly here in Dallas as well. Oh, well, what can you do?
It was warm somewhere. Where was it? Oh, the West Coast was quite warm, unusually warm. But everywhere else is pretty cold.
Lovely. Well, tell you what, we've actually got a couple of authors to talk to tonight, and I know we have one of them waiting for us, so why don't we jump right in. This is BC Radio Live, live every week at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio, and co-hosting with Eric and Lisa, I'm Philip. Well, really, I'm just announcing, I guess. I'm like the Ryan Seacrest of BC Radio Live.
Yes, but we all know that deep down, he's the star of the show.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yes.
Oh, well, I'm giving up the second half of this week's American Idol Part 2 to be on the show tonight. So hopefully I won't miss anything.
I got to tell you, interrupt. I'm done. I'm over. I'm over with American Idol.
Really? You've given up now?
Yeah. I didn't watch last season. I mean, I kind of watched the beginning, and then Dawn and Lily were watching it on and off. But even they never really connected with it the way we had. We missed the first season, but we'd watched every other one. And I realized, man, I just saved hours and hours and hours and hours of time that I'm not sitting watching crappy singers singing crappy songs that are really crappy and I hate.
Well, Tuesday night happens to be family night at my house. So if we didn't spend that time watching American Idol, we'd spend it watching something else, a movie, and probably something bad like by Disney. So for me, it's not really too much lost time. Although I did state at the beginning of this year that they've got Kelly Clarkson for the ladies, they've got David Cook for the guys, or maybe it's the other way around, and they've got Carrie Underwood tearing up the country charts. I think they're done. I mean, I'm pretty sure they're not going to top that. So
it's diminishing returns at this point.
We'll see what they manage to do. Anyway. Sorry for the side rail there. I just can't help it. Sales often seems to be a game with a winner and a loser, but Randy Illig has co-written a book called Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play, which suggests that sales doesn't need to be that way. You can find the book on Amazon. It's a Franklin Covey book, and welcome to BC Radio Live, Randy.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad that I can join you this evening.
As are we, we'd be talking about the weather and American Idol otherwise.
Well, it's much more interesting, I think, to talk about books. I love hearing about new books. I've got a couple of Franklin Covey books, obviously, various books about habits and so on. But this is actually about, very specifically, sales and transforming this relationship, that a salesperson ought to behave differently in order to make sales. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. I think the fundamental behavior shift we're talking about here is most salespeople focus on what? Their own numbers, fair? They're trying to make their quota, pay their bills, earn a living, and yet there's an interesting paradox that if you actually stop focusing on your own numbers and start focusing on your clients' numbers, helping them achieve the kind of business results they need, they want, and they value, you'll actually get what you want. And that's the shift that we're actually talking about in the book, and providing some practical how-to advice to just change that relationship and make it much more productive.
It's kind of an Eastern philosophy approach to things. There's this tenet called Wu Wei in Taoism. Don't ask, I know all this stupid crap. But in Wu Wei, you achieve all, in theory, you know, the phrasing is all, achieve all by doing nothing. And it doesn't really mean doing nothing, but what it does mean is to sort of absorb the energy and the wants and the desires of the people or entity that you're working with and reflect those back to them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, when we talk to customers, commercial buyers out there, and you ask them to share the buying experiences that they thought were the most productive, that yielded the most value, the kinds of things they used to describe those experiences would include, hey, you know, when we were talking with the seller, it was clear they were focusing on helping us get what we wanted. They were really trying to understand where we were, what we were trying to achieve. And at the end, it was easy to choose them. Sometimes we were willing to pay a lot more for that, because we really thought that they were working in our best interest and we would get what we really valued. Here's the funny thing. When you ask customers, well, how many of those experiences do you have? They say very few and too few. And so it's something they really desire, but so many sellers actually miss that. So there's a huge opportunity for sellers to actually change their perspective and relate to buyers in a whole new way.
Well, how much of that do you think has to do with sellers not really necessarily believing in their product? You know, I mean, because you basically have to really believe that what you can do is actually solve your customer's problem before this approach makes any sense, right?
Yeah, I think there's a big element of confidence in one's product and company that is required, and confidence in oneself to actually represent something to a customer that everyone would feel proud about. The funny thing is, you know, often people say, well, there's only one best, and, you know, I'm not working for a company that has the best in class. And when you talk with clients, you say, are you looking for the very best thing, or are you looking for good choices that will help you get or solve the problem you're trying to solve, get the result you're trying to get? They often say, we're not looking for the best thing out there. We're looking for something that will help us get what we want. And so it's easy to have confidence in what you're delivering if it will really help a client get what they value.
And if
yes,
you're honest,
you have
about
to have
that.
Confidence.
And you have to be honest.
Pardon me?
And you have to be honest, it would seem.
You do have to be honest. And we carve those things out. We call them yellow lights, right? So if something doesn't smell right or feel right or you're sensing it's not right, say it. Tactfully put that on the table with a client and just say to them, as I'm hearing you describe what you're saying or what you're looking for, we may not be the best fit. Here's what my concern is. What do you think we ought to do? And often they'll actually say, well, hold on a minute. Let's keep talking through this because I'm not so sure that there isn't a good fit here. And so honesty, you know, it's a kind of a cliche, if you will, but honesty really pays. It does help you get what you want by helping other people get what they want and being straight with them.
Yeah, that's a relief, you know, because, wow, it's hard. It's so hard. I for me, in my life, I found out pretty early on that it's so much easier for me to just be pretty much honest. I mean, I don't think anyone's literally 100% honest, but, you know, in personal relationships and business and everything else, to be as close to honest as I can, because then I don't have to remember what I said, you know?
Exactly.
I don't have to remember what I told people.
You're exactly right, and here's a funny thing. I mean, just put ourselves in any situation, social, business, whatever it is, you ask almost any human being, can you sense when somebody's not being straight with you? And what do we all say?
Yes, usually.
Yeah, absolutely we can sense this.
Even if you don't know exactly what the problem is, you know that there is a problem.
Exactly. So if you're in sales and you're not being straight with a customer and you think they don't know, I mean, the only person you're fooling is yourself. They know.
I looked through quite a bit of the book, by the way, and it's very well written, easy to understand. It certainly does not talk down to people. A lot of the sales kind of oriented stuff gets so much into the kind of the hokey, you know, motivational stuff, and it just sounds hokey. Yours is written intelligently, you know, not esoterically, but certainly intelligently, yet clearly, and I think you do a really good job on it. Before we get into more details, which I think there's well worth getting into, you know, your actual approach, I had a question. It seemed to me, just kind of from the overview, that this kind of sales approach or your ability to really throw yourself into your kind of sales approach probably applies more to the higher end kind of sales. In other words, if you're just selling a huge volume of something cheap and disposable, that's probably less relevant than if you're actually going to be interacting on an ongoing basis with, say, a relatively few number of relatively high-end customers. Does that make sense?
Yes, but not that stark. I would say that, you know, wherever you are as a seller interacting with a customer over, you know, some multiple step sales cycle, this is a good book for you because it will give practical how to actually bridge the gap and win more business, and that could be selling something pretty simple at a low dollar value, up to something very complex. But I think the qualifier is more how many steps there are in the sales cycle and how you interact with the client, not necessarily the complexity of the product or pricing of it.
Okay, well, that makes sense. The other question or just thought that I had about all this, it just slipped my mind. So let's move on. It'll come back. It always does. Why don't we get into your key beliefs? You have five key beliefs that kind of set up your philosophy and approach. Oh, I know what I was going to say. It seems to me it's also pretty required that your company back you up on this, because this approach may take more patience, may take a little more time. Does that make sense too?
Well, I think that's a common belief that I would challenge. I would suggest that following this process is actually more efficient, is actually faster, because one of the things you're able to do is find the opportunities you shouldn't be chasing and get out of those and invest your time in the ones you should be chasing and you should be pursuing. And the prescribed methods that we lay out actually help you get to decision gates sooner rather than later. So I would suggest that it's actually, in the end, faster, even though it might first look like it might take more time.
Okay, well, I'm dead wrong.
Well, not dead wrong. It's a common belief. I mean, people commonly look at this process of ours and they say, oh, my gosh, I don't have time to spend all this time with a client and understand what's going on for them.
Lay the groundwork.
Pardon?
Lay the groundwork.
Yeah, but somehow they feel they do have time to submit proposals that will never be purchased, to pursue conversations with no defined end or no decision at the end of them. So it's just a shift from chasing numbers to working a little bit smarter, doing more on less instead of doing more with less.
Well, that makes perfect sense too. Before we forget, because sometimes we do, we get caught up in fascinating conversations. Is there a website that you can we can refer people to?
Absolutely. You can find out all about us and our book at franklincovey.com. And when you go to franklincovey.com, you can just go to the Sales Performance Group, and that's us.
Okay, and Covey is C-O-B-E-Y.
It is.
Okay, excellent. Well, let's get back to let's get into a little more detail then. Would you like to run through the key beliefs that you start off with?
Well, we can, and I would offer another track for the amount of time we have, which is, you know, in this economy, one of the things we're often faced with is how do you sell in this kind of an economy when customers are being more conservative than ever with their money. And I think the fundamental idea around that is to, if you can't help your clients figure out the economic return on whatever it is you're selling and compare it to the other choices that they have, you're not going to succeed in any economy. And it's more true in this economy than ever. And so as you read through our book, I think there's just a tremendous amount of practical guidance on how you create the business case and build momentum for what it is, what solution it is you want to put on the table for a given client to help them get to a point where they see good return and they can move ahead with you. If you can't do that, you're not going to sell in this economy or in any economy, but it's more difficult right now.
Okay, well, so far I'm 0-4, so let's just keep up with my perfect record of being wrong every time. And
now, come on, you're not wrong every time.
No, I'm joking. Kind of. Why don't you – can you give us an example of that then? Maybe walk us through that process that you just described. It certainly sounds extremely important in all economies, but certainly a slow one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the fundamental ideas that we believe in is that solutions, so our product or a given solution, actually has no inherent value. And it actually derives value from either solving a problem that someone cares about or helping someone, a company or a person, achieve a result that they assign high value to. And yet when you look at sales is often about advocating something, about telling about our product or our experiences, and somehow we think that customers will hear that and suddenly want to buy it. And we skip this fundamental idea that, no, actually we've got to understand what's going on for them. So we lay out a 5-step model for understanding what the key business situation is that a client is facing. That includes the key business issues that they want to address, the problems they're facing or results they want to achieve. How those things show up, we call that evidence. So how would that manifest in the business? What's it worth, impact? So dollars and cents, what's it cost to own the problem you have, or what's the upside of the result you'll get if you address that? The 4th step is context. And we're talking here about, well, who does this affect? I mean, your customers, your employees, other departments. So who's involved in this game? And then last is constraints. What might actually prevent the client from moving ahead? And that forms the first element of the business case. So it's a very straightforward, we call it structured conversation, that's easy for people to use. Customers are willing to engage in that dialogue very often to help the seller understand what's going on in the buyer so that they can begin to quantify that and help the client make a good decision one way or another about moving ahead or not.
Wow. Well, that makes perfect sense and is very logical. Now, I just, again, kind of have random thoughts because that's the way my disjointed brain works. Being that you are advocating, we are advocating honesty, presenting difficult questions, all of this is toward the end of assisting the customers in whatever way you can, reduce costs, improve efficiency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me, in the course of doing that, you need to be very careful how you present those difficult questions, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You absolutely do. Sometimes if you think back on any interaction you've had with another person, sometimes the toughest conversations are actually the ones that build the relationship. And yet, if not dealt with in a tactful way, they can actually do the opposite. They can crush the relationship. And so because of that fear, people often avoid tough conversations, asking tough questions. And so one of the things that we've done is framed actual script-like approaches for how you ask tough questions, how you put challenging situations on the table. And we're not suggesting you read the book and follow our scripts exactly. What we're suggesting is there's a pattern to how you would communicate that once made authentic to your personality and natural for the way that you communicate will enable you to put tough situations on the table in a way that's tactful and people will be willing to talk to you about it.
Well, that sounds good, too. I can always use help in that regard. I'm not always terribly tactful. And by the way, what is your? How do you pronounce your co-author's name?
Mahan Khalsa.
That's what I would have guessed. Sometimes I'm right. Hey, I'm
I was just going to say that.
I'm 1 for 5. You know, I'm hitting 200. It's not great, you know, but I'm at the Mendoza line for baseball.
You're deliberately asking those silly questions, you know, to represent the average listener.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
presenting common misconceptions. I'm playing devil's advocate.
Sure.
By the way, I love in the book how on every – is it every – well, it's almost every page, or at least many pages, you have a very interesting quotes from people, and it's a broad cross-section. You have the East, the West, and by East I mean Asia – in the West, the Western world, you have business, you have literature, you have all kinds of people, very pithy quotes, you know, supporting that shows quite a bit of learning here. How did you track those quotes down?
Well, I'd have to give that credit to Mahan. Mahan has collected a lot of those quotes throughout his career, and as we talked about the structure of the book, he said to me one day when we were working on it, you know, I'd like to build these quotes in. I've collected these all my life, and we kind of went through them. And so I'd give all that credit to him. I think he did a nice job, and thanks for carving that out.
No problem. Yeah, I always like little sidebar things or quotes or, you know, it broadens your context, and it gives you something to think about that kind of takes you out of the immediate setting and broadens things out a bit. And yeah, I always enjoy that. It's nice to have you know, some different perspectives and some variety. And I don't know, there's just something about you know, authoritative quotes that probably psychologically anyway, you know, really help bring home the message to your readers. You know, have
sure.
an air of authority about it. All right. Well, Philip, you've heard me go 1 for 5. Any questions here? By the way, if you can stay with us, we tonight, unlike a lot of nights where we have 4 15-minute segments, tonight we're actually on 2 half-hour segments, and so we do have a little bit more time. If that's okay with you.
Okay with me.
Yes.
I'd love to spend a little bit more time with you.
Excellent. We've already used 22 minutes, so that went pretty quickly, I must say. So, Philip, Lisa, any thoughts, questions, different perspectives?
Well, unfortunately, and we've just been talking about this in the chat room, you're the only one of the three of us that's actually seen a copy of the book yet, Eric. So that puts us at a little bit of a handicap. But I'm very interested in, I mean, I guess, does this book mostly grow out of things that Franklin Covey's done in seminars, or is it something new for Franklin Covey, or how does it come about?
Well, how the book really came about is through Mahan and my individual experiences running businesses and selling throughout our lives. I met Mahan about 10 years ago. Because I owned a company and I was looking for a very robust approach to getting great at selling, because we weren't. And I met him and he helped me and we stayed in touch. And so the book comes out of field experience doing this for real. So it didn't come out of the laboratory. Nothing wrong with laboratory books, but this isn't one of them. And the connection to Franklin Covey is Franklin Covey acquired Mahan's company some years ago, and we've both done some work for Franklin Covey and continue to do so. So that's our overall connection. But the book really comes from doing this.
Well, what kind of response have you seen so far from people who are, you know, I guess on either side, but primarily from salespeople who've read it and tried to apply it already in their career?
Well, we've been applying this whole approach for, you know, more than 10 years, and worked literally with thousands of salespeople all around the globe, different countries, different languages, different kinds of companies, and you know, people love this stuff. Now, like anything, there are groupies to any kind of idea, and so we have a big following of folks who sell business to business products and services that really need to be sold in the context of creating business value. And so literally hundreds of thousands of people use this approach. And the book is selling very, very well. We're delighted with how well it's doing. And so it's got a pretty big following.
Cool. Hey, I want to talk about, because at first I was slightly confused about the meaning of the term until I thought about it for a second. But clearly it's really key for salespeople of every kind, and that is qualifying it. And I assume by that you mean you're qualifying the opportunity, you're qualifying the potential buyer. Is that correct?
Well, yes, and we look at qualifying a little bit more holistically than that. Like qualifying is normally the standard sales definition is, can this customer buy? Do they have money? Are they the right people? Those kinds of things. So if you think about those kinds of qualification questions, they're very much focused on the seller's side of that equation, and that's important. When we think of qualification, we also include in that the buyer's side of that qualification, right? So if there isn't a strong business case, it really doesn't matter about any of those other qualification elements. If they can't see very clearly that solving a problem or creating a result and doing that with their resources makes good sense for their business, they're not going to move ahead regardless of how sexy or novel or how well-priced or positioned our product is. So we think of qualification in the context of both the buyer and the seller.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Gosh, we have burned nearly a half hour.
Well, I hope we weren't burning it.
It's kind of amazing. Well, I mean that always in the positive sense, because, man, there is nothing that is less fun than when the conversation does not go, and you're sitting there counting not only minutes, but seconds. Oh, my God, was that only 30 seconds? Holy crap. No, that's always good. No,
Fortunately, we very, very rarely have had those moments here on BC Radio Live.
Yeah, we really have, because we all blab a lot, especially me.
And if you do, you can talk about American Idol.
Well,
there you go. We fill in the most random, completely random things. It's absolutely amazing to me. Now, is this book aimed more at the experienced salesperson, or one of the things I found frustrating when I engaged in a very, very, very brief career in sales was that a lot of the books, either intentionally or unintentionally, seem to assume that you're familiar with more than I was, at least. I mean, like I know Eric, not knowing the term qualifying, that was something I remember reading about, but how much knowledge should someone have before picking up this book?
Well, I want to just point out, I don't mean to sound like, well, this book is for everyone, and yet at the same time, here's what people tell me. Whether they're brand new to sales or they've been doing it all their life, when they work with us or they read our material, they all get things out of it. They get different things. So the newbie, somebody that's brand new to selling says, oh, my gosh, I found a process. I found something that I can replicate and go do, and I now know how to move forward. While someone that's been doing this for 25 years will say, they might zero in on a particular thing and say, my gosh, I've forgotten how important it was to really get totally dialed into the decision-making process, and the work that you did around that just really brought that back to life, and I'm going to reincorporate that into what I'm doing. So there's pretty broad applicability and value recognition wherever people are on that continuum of experience.
Oh, very good. Fortunately, it's got a lot of stuff in it. So, even if you only find one or two things in the book, 10% of the book, you're still getting your money's worth. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, and, that's often how salespeople think, right? Like, if they can make an investment and get one or two good nuggets out of it that help them do their jobs better and further what their causes are with their families, their companies, and their clients, it's a good return. And if you look at the ratings that the book has on Amazon or any place else, they're pretty solid.
I did, yeah. You've got you know, it's always suspicious when you see only 5-star ratings, because it's hard to believe that not even one kook has found something. But, I mean, even your low ratings tend to be 3-4 stars and say, wow, I really like this book, but, you know, some little complaint here or there. So it seems to be extremely well regarded on Amazon.
Yeah, I think we've been very fortunate the book resonates with people and the approach resonates with people.
I think it's pretty clear that it is, you know, hard won, the information in here, and that you guys didn't just sit down and write a book, but that it has stuff that you've been working on, well, you said for 10 years. I think that's pretty clear, and I'm sure that's a large part of why people have responded as well as they have, because it's tried and true stuff that you have worked out in the real world.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, the book is called Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play, Transforming the Buyer-Seller Relationship. It's available now at Amazon.com. You can also find information at franklincovey.com. And thank you very much for talking with us tonight, Randy.
Well, thank you, Philip and Lisa and Eric. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show and have a great balance of the day.
Thank you very much. You too. Good luck.
Well, BC Radio Live is a production of blogcritics.org, BC Magazine, and is broadcast weekly at blogtalkradio.com/BC Radio, which is where we are right now. With Eric and Lisa, I am Philip. Talent, I say, is overrated, and I'm not just, well, not only being a bitter loser here. That's actually the title of Jeff Holden's book, Talent is Overrated, What Really Separates World-Class Performers from Everybody Else. His website is jeffcolvin.com, that's jeffcolvin.com, and he suggests that the key to success isn't necessarily innate talent, but the result of, let's ask him. Welcome to BC Radio Live, Jeff.
Hi, it's great to talk to you. What is it the result of?
Why don't you tell us?
I'll tell you, and let me say before I tell it that this is not my own opinion that we're stating here. The book is based on a bunch of scientific research that I have come across and really been fascinated by, and it's quite impressive. Anyway, the answer as to what really separates world-class performers from everybody else is what the researchers call deliberate practice. And
thank you. Good night.
That's the answer. There
just
we
kidding.
Are.
I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. Go ahead.
It isn't what most of us think of when we think we're practicing something. I learned, for example, that what I do on the driving range at the golf course is a pathetic example of practice, as the researchers actually describe it. It's a very specific activity, although it's pretty straightforward, and that is what all the world's great performers in every field seem to have in common. They do it a lot, sometimes hours a day, for years on end, and it does create great performers.
Well, it certainly makes sense because we were just talking in between work and getting back to the office for the show tonight. My 9-year-old daughter is quite a talented singer, and she's had a lot of real, real positive feedback, and she's had, for her age, dozens of public performances, and I can't think of any that haven't gone well. But we keep telling her, the older you get, the farther you go, you're going to run into more and more people who have the same natural abilities you do, who have that same talent, who have that same knack, but they may work harder than you because she does not like to practice. She takes a weekly class, she practices there, she works on it if she feels like it. If she really likes the song, she'll work on it more on her own. She'll work on it on her own just prior to a performance, but that's it. And we were just telling her that this kind of stuff is the kind of stuff where you have to do it over and over and over till it's just absolutely second nature, where you don't have to think about it.
Right. And in that story about your daughter, you have touched on so many elements of this that are really important. Everything you say is exactly right. She's going to run into more and more people as she gets better, as she advances. And what is going to distinguish one from the other is how much of this practice activity they put into it. Now, in music, practice is, of course, a well-understood, well-defined, and well-accepted concept. People know how to do it, and they understand the importance of it. You also touched on something that's really important, which is she seems to be good for her age. And in almost any activity, it turns out that if you're especially good for your age, that's a huge advantage, because you said something else. You said she gets a lot of praise for it. This is one of the advantages. If you get a lot of praise, that can be a good motivator, and it triggers what some of the researchers call the multiplier effect. You know, a small advantage that then builds and builds and builds. You know, you get some praise that makes you work a little harder, you get a little better, you attract better teachers, et cetera, et cetera. But there is no shortcut to great success. That's one of the main lessons from all this research. But that's excellent news, and this is the point that is most important in the book, because what it says is you don't need that one in a million gift, that special targeted ability that we all think you've either got or you don't. In fact, you don't need that, and there are even some researchers who say that targeted gifts, you know, things that make somebody a great oboe player or golfer or jet pilot or organizational leader, that those targeted gifts may not even exist. It's what you do in the way of regular, hard, demanding, deliberate practice. In other words, great achievement is available to everybody. You don't have to have that one in a million magical thing.
Well, that is encouraging to those of us who have many interests, but not you know, super spectacular gifts in any one area. I've always felt pulled my whole life, pulled in different directions. I'm interested in this, I'm interested in that, I'm interested in writing, I'm interested in music, on and on and on. And yet no one of them has ever absolutely, you know, just grabbed me by the throat and been the really obvious thing for me to do. And at times I felt it's a disadvantage because I'm easily distracted. I'm oh, wow, that's interesting. I'm really focused on this, but oh, that's really interesting. But you're saying that approach to life can also work as long as you are willing to practice, you know, at the various things that you're interested in. You can't expect to be good without practice.
You can't expect to be good without practice, and you can expect to be good with the practice. That is absolutely the case. But now you've touched on something else that's really important, which is that oh, can you hold on half a second? Sorry. This will keep straight for quite a long time. The great world-class performers do make a decision. And look, if you're going to become Tiger Woods, you know, you're not going to have much time in your life for anything other than golf. And so they do make a decision where they say, I am not going to go down all these other roads. I am going to focus on one. I'm going to, you know, give up these other things I might have thought about doing, and I am going to focus entirely on this one thing. And that is a price that true world-class performance demands, and it's a real choice that people have to make about their lives. You know, am I going to do this or not? And I don't say it's an obvious choice. You know, people have lives to think about. You got to decide how much you're willing to sacrifice. But that really is what it comes down to.
What came to my mind, you mentioned Tiger Woods, of course, and I think sports, maybe it's just easier to understand, you know, the analogy or the application of that concept to sports, because, you know, we can visualize that actual, and like music too, of course, we can visualize the actual specific actions involved with the practice. But what came to mind just now to me when you were talking, I was picturing those little tiny gymnast girls and people, you know, people. It really is. It's something you have to – I can – like so many things. I see both sides of it. You know, on the one hand, my God, these poor little girls or boys or whoever, they don't have lives. You know, from dusk to dawn, everything is dictated. They have nothing but this specific event, this act, one activity from a very, very, very early age. And, you know, in China, they're talking about the gymnasts taking over, going to gymnast school, dedicating their lives to it at 3 years old. And
yeah.
And so that's the one side of it. That's awful. It's terrible. How can they do that? On the other side of it, you talk to athletes, you talk to people, and what little success I had in the athletic arena. I mean, it's a tremendous feeling to be good at those things.
Right.
And it's, and to be world class, my goodness, you know, I mean, how unusual is that? And you don't hear that many athletes coming out of it, you know, down the road, who say that they regret it. Some do, but not too many, it doesn't seem like to me.
Yeah, and what you are talking about there is a big question for all of us who are parents, because especially in sports and in music, if a kid is going to become truly world class, they have to start unbelievably early. You know, I mean, Tiger Woods' father put a club in his hand at the age of 7 months, was teaching him and taking him to the course for practice at the age of two. And the gymnasts you mentioned, you know, now they get started at the age of three and so forth. And the advantages of deliberate practice, the effects, are cumulative. The more thousands of hours you can rack up, the better you will be. And frankly, that is why Tiger is the world's dominant golfer, and nobody will ever catch him, because he has more accumulated hours of intense deliberate practice than anybody else on the tour, and he continues to be about the hardest working man in golf. So he continues to rack up even more thousands of hours every year, which means as long as he wants to keep this up, nobody's going to catch him. Now, was it good for his father to start him down this road at an age when he couldn't possibly make up his own mind about it? Or, as you say, was it maybe barbaric, you know, for a parent to do this to a kid? Now, in Tiger's case, it was great. He loved his father. He adored his father. He became the world's greatest golfer. It's all a wonderful, wonderful story. But we also encounter, we've all seen the stories of parents who push too hard, who make the kids angry and resentful, and it is really tough. But as parents, we got to decide, are we going to push them early when they're still too young to make up their own mind? I was talking to a friend of mine about this. His daughter at age six had just started taking piano lessons, and the parents said to the piano teacher, do you think she could ever really be a truly great pianist? And the teacher said, no, it's too late.
Six, wow.
She can be great. She can have a lot of fun. You know, she can be excellent. But she can't be the world's greatest. So this is the world we're in.
It is amazing. It's not even. I was just thinking, as you said, it, you know, about the accumulated hours, and obviously the younger you start, the more hours you can accumulate. But the younger you are, the more malleable you are too. Of course.
And there's interesting, fascinating research on that and how your brain works. Deliberate practice not only gives you, you know, knowledge and ability, it literally, actually, changes your brain. Certain areas of your brain get bigger as a result of this, and scientists have studied it. And the effect is largest when you're a kid, although it can still happen when you're an adult. We didn't used to think that was true. We'd all been taught that, you know, after adulthood, you can't grow any new neurons. You can't, your brain isn't malleable. In fact, it is. And by the way, the other thing is, you know, we're talking about sports and music, you know, and you've got to start by the age of three. Hold on, please. Left here. You got to start by the age of three. And so, fortunately, it isn't that way in business, in what most of us do for a living. Nobody starts developing little Donald Trumps and Jack Welch's at the age of four, you know.
Richie Rich.
You see that movie?
Did you
see the Richie Rich movie? Do you remember the scene where, in fact, they were teaching them to be little Jack Welch's and Donald Trump's, and they were all in class, and Ben Stein was the teacher and so forth. It was very funny. Anyway, in real life, nobody really does it. We don't start until we get out of school. So, you know, we actually have a much greater chance to get a good start.
Hey, Lisa, guess what I was thinking about when the topic just came up a few minutes ago about adults being able to learn and whatnot?
Yes.
What was I thinking about?
You were thinking about my husband playing the banjo at an advanced age.
Exactly. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, my husband took up the banjo about, I guess maybe 2 years ago now, and he's in his late 50s.
He's much older than you, of course.
He's much older than everybody we know. He's like older than dirt, but that's not the point here. He's a big believer in the notion that learning new things, you know, will keep him young and keep his brain alive. And he comes upstairs every night and practices for an hour. And he's, you know, well aware of the fact that he's not ever going to be Earl Scruggs, but he's learned something, never having picked up an instrument in his life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. And what a great story, because it shows a number of things. One, you know, by applying oneself, it really is possible to do this. And, you know, and he can have a lot of fun and, you know, and get tremendous enjoyment and frankly, become much better than sort of conventional wisdom would tell you was possible. It's also good that he's being realistic about it because, you know, starting at that age, you're right. He's not going to be Earl Scruggs. But so what? You know, as long as he's realistic, it's a great thing.
Yeah, I personally just don't want to be the world class anything just because I'm too lazy.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
No, I've decided I don't want to be world-class anything because I'm just far too lazy. I don't want to put in that kind of work.
Well, and see, that's a perfectly legitimate decision to make, in my opinion. You know, here's an interesting story, I think, that illustrates it pretty well. It's the story of the Polgar sisters. Some people know the story. Most people don't seem to. There was a guy in Hungary named Laszlo Polgar who decided that it was possible to raise a kid to be a true great world-class performer at pretty much anything if you really focused on it. And he wrote a book about it. He advertised for a woman who would marry him so that they could have kids and put his theory into practice. And incredibly enough, he found such a woman. They got married. They had three daughters. And they decided to make them great, truly great, world-class great chess players. And so from the time these girls were 3 or 4 years old, they did basically nothing but chess. They were schooled at home. They never went to a school. They simply stayed at home, and all day, every day, they worked on chess. They had to learn other stuff. The authorities demanded that they, you know, pass tests for school subjects. But their lives were devoted to chess. And they, in fact, became the highest-rated female chess players on planet Earth. Some of them became in the top 10 of all chess players. The youngest one, Judith Polgar, became the youngest player of either sex to become a grandmaster. She did it months earlier than Bobby Fischer had done it many years before. And yet, when they got to be 20 or 21, two of them gave it up. And as one of them said memorably, "It isn't that chess was too much for me. It wasn't enough." She wanted to have a life, you know. Mm-hmm. She said, I just don't want to pursue this anymore. There's more to life than this, and there's nothing wrong with that. We all have lives, and we all have to make a decision about what we're going to devote ourselves to. So that's fine.
a positive side of that too is I am certain that she, having achieved that level of skill at anything, doesn't matter what, anything,
right,
at that relatively early in age, 2021, could apply those same skills, those same learning skills, those practice skills, ways of thinking, modeling, et cetera, to anything else that she would do. So it's not like the time was wasted.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, you know, here's someone who had become incredibly skilled at something, and so it's a wonderful thing to have done, and it enriched her life enormously, no matter what else she wanted to do.
I've always felt that sports, you get a lot of, there's, you know, again, there's two sides to everything. There's kind of our whole culture, and it's certainly not only the U.S. In a lot of ways, it's most of, or much anyway, of the world are kind of sports nuts, and we admire, you know, whatever the sport may be, we really admire and put on pedestal the people who have actually very, if you think about it, stop and think about it, very arcane kind of skills, or, you know, they're huge, they're fast, or this or that, that has relatively little to do with the real world. But I've always felt that the true importance of sports and what really does justify and I think, you know, makes their place of prominence, if not, you know, fully justified, at least to my mind personally, you know, mostly justified, is just that you are picking up those skills. You are learning how to do something. You're learning teamwork. You're learning how to push yourself. You're learning what your own limits are, how to push up against those limits, perhaps go past them, but also know when to pull back. Because, you know, if you're injured, you can't do anything. You can't practice. You can't play. So those skills, it seems to me, you know, really are important and applicable. And you know, there's lots and lots of studies that show, you know, kind of just that. If you do sports to the neglect of your studies, then, you know, that's a whole other thing. If you get by on sports alone and you keep getting promoted up simply because you're good at sports, that's not doing anyone any favors, I don't think. But, you know, if you have a relatively balanced life and you're at least, you know, getting by with your studies, that sports really is a very good foundation for life. And, you know, it seems like a lot of people do well in business, you know, who've been good in sports. You know, it's, a lot of it's the social aspect of it, but social aspect counts.
Yeah, that it does count. And I think you put your finger on it, you know, most importantly, the success in sports has taught them essentially the message of this book, the lesson of this book, which is that on the one hand, there isn't any shortcut. There isn't any magic in becoming great. It's a matter of demanding application over a long period of time. And it is hard. It really is asking a lot. But the good side of it, the great side of it, is that it works. If you are willing to do it, you will achieve success. And if people have learned that through sports, they are way ahead of everybody else when it comes to the rest of life, because it's just as true in business, in anything else you want to do, as it is in sports.
Very well, nice. It's a double-edged sword, like you say.
Yeah, it is. It is, but it is ultimately a liberating message, and this is what I always try to emphasize. It is ultimately a liberating message because it tells people that it doesn't matter if they think they haven't been given this special gift. It doesn't matter. They can still be really, really good performers.
By the way, speaking of success, congratulations on the success of the book. I was... saw some really, you know, you're like around 100 in Amazon. It's already been out for a couple months, so usually, you know, they peak right away. And, you know, it's been really well received, it appears.
It really has been. It's just been doing terrifically, and I'm so, so happy about it because I frankly didn't know what to expect. As of this moment when we're speaking, it is on bestseller lists in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Business Week, and it's been just great.
That's very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, Jeff's website is jeffcolvin.com. That's GeoffColvin.com. And the book is called Talent is Overrated, What Really Separates World-Class Performers from Everybody Else. Thank you very much for spending time with us on the show tonight, Jeff.
Hey, it's my great pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. Very interesting stuff. Very provocative. Now I got to go back and think.
Well, we have reached the end of the show for this week, yet another week. Please do join us again next week. In fact, join us every week. In fact, go through the archives and listen to all the past weeks. Thanks again to Jeff Colvin.
Dedicate your life to it. Practice.
That's right. Thanks also to Randy Illig for earlier in the show. And, of course, special thanks to Lisa and Eric for hosting the show. I'm Philip Wynn, and this has been BC Radio Live. We do broadcast live every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, so be sure to visit us to participate in the chat room, watch the live video feed. If you miss the live broadcast, audio archives are available online, or you can subscribe to the podcast to have BC Radio Live delivered to you each and every week automatically. And thank you all, and aloha until next week.